So, assignment is due today. Please submit it. I plan to put up solutions very soon. So whether you can get credit for the assignment is dependent on whether I post the solutions. So please get it in on time or really close to on time. I'm willing to answer questions about this, but before I talk about that, I want to note I've looked at experience submissions. Only 9 of you have submitted the first experience. Now, I'm okay with that, except that, I'm right now entering in all the experiences into CU Learn. I've got them all up. Basically, I kind of worked it out. It's like, to do this, it'd be every Monday, so February 5th, February 12th, then not during winter break, then the 26th, then the 5th, then, it basically goes through March 26th every week, if you want to get it. So they just keep coming. So, you miss this one, and then come next Monday, you've missed another. It's like, okay, you're going to catch up, but, each of these things will take you a chunk of time. So, I don't care much about the precise time, but if you don't start to get things done on a roughly weekly basis, you're going to be in pain.
Mm-hmm. What do they all do?
What do they all do?
Yeah.
Would I want them all done?
Yeah.
I will accept them through the last day of classes. Exam period is for grading. I don't want to see a darn thing. But the last official deadline is March 26th, and I highly recommend you get it done by then. Because remember, there's a final exam in this course, and you need to be thinking about the concepts. And so if you're spending your time, not to say the hacking isn't fun and interesting and good to learn about things, but that should be ongoing. And if you put it all to the end of the semester, you're going to be in a lot of pain. So please, try to follow the deadlines. And in particular, some of these things will be much easier than others. Like, for example, just trying to modify your router and stuff to block a protocol and stuff, that should not be that hard. Trying to do that on your host, trying to do that on your computer, trying to do the network firewall, trying to do the application, that one should not be that hard. Writing a full password implementation, that's a harder one. But again, you can get most of the credit for that by doing some of it. We'll try to see if we can come up with some other ones today related to the material. But you should be able to find ones that you can do that aren't too hard. And if you have ideas for ones you want to do, propose them, and I'm happy to, I'm happy to entertain different ones that things you're interested in exploring. Question about the assignment. I'm not going to go through all the questions now, but if you have any specific that seems like I don't know where to go to try to answer this one.
I think there was a typo on I think 10, or maybe 11.
Okay.
It has to do with the TCP wrappers and...
what is the key? 10, okay, what?
It's just missing a word at the end.
Yeah, you just wanted to make sure it was...
TDR and host bay firewalls... this provide is redundant. This shouldn't be there. Defend against similar threat. What type of threats do they protect against?
The one below question 10.
Oh, sorry, that's not. But that provide defend, that provide should be gone. And what is the key technology between how TCP wrappers and host-based firewall? Why shouldn't have the how?
Okay.
So I'll edit that right now. Edit. Okay. So which one was it? I'll say work. Edit frost. Is there anything else? This is one of the things I... There's no what?
It
says
edit.
It says, oh, it says edit? Wait, what? Hmm?
No. Question number two.
Okay. Oh, yes. Well, that's number two. Is. Thank you. This is one thing I love about using a wiki. It's like, you change it, it's there. And if you're wondering who's been messing with it, you can see the history. See exactly who edited everything. Okay, so pretty straightforward. Okay. Then let's.
Anil, I do have a question regarding the experiences.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that we were going to put up some readings where we could go look for security readings and then talk about like papers.
Right.
There is a link or. Foundational security papers one.
Yes, I have that there, and I was meaning to fill that in.
Okay.
So that's I need to add to the experiences every week. So this week I have to put up assignment two. And put up assignment two, finish solutions for assignment one, and expand the experiences page, which is yes. So.
Can we suggest paper stuff?
Yes. Put it on Slack. So I can, that's, and then we can discuss it. I can kind of look at it, and I'll probably say, okay, that's good. If I do that, they'll probably do the other papers or something, you know. Because when you say papers, it's like, what topic? You know, it's like, there's so many papers. Okay, now we have light. And I have my one piece of chalk. So today I said I was going to talk about networking because we keep touching on that. And I kind of realized that in order for me to talk about the security of networking, I have to kind of give a top to bottom review of what we're talking about with networking. So, basis of the internet. What's the basis of the internet? What makes it work? It's one thing. What's the one thing that makes the internet the internet? Come on.
Connections?
No. It's
wire.
Nope.
Packet.
The IP packet. That is what makes the internet work because if you want to connect to the internet, all you need is a way to send and receive IP packets. And, well, two things. You need to be able to send and receive IP packets, and you need to be able to send it to someone who at least purports to be able to send it to the rest of the internet. If you can send and receive packets to someone who can send it to the rest of the internet, you are connected to the internet. And everyone along the line basically is saying, I can send and receive IP packets to this portion of the internet or this portion of the internet. That's what routing is sending IP packets. So it all comes down to the IP packet. And in order, and you can say, well, what about Ethernet and Wi-Fi? It's like, it's ways of sending IP packets. You all have heard about the carrier pigeon RFC, right?
Yes.
So you can, there is an RFC, so a standard. RFCs are requests for comments. That's how the internet was standardized. It was a very interesting process, but it's still ongoing. But there is an RFC for sending IP packets by carrier pigeon. Not what I recommend. Performance characteristics are not ideal. Lost packets are kind of sad. You know, your pigeon got lost. Dropped on the floor might literally mean a pigeon dropped on the floor. I mean, it's not a fun image. But it's packets. This is it. And so when you look at the security of the internet, it's really about the security of these IP packets. So what's an IP packet? What's it got? It's, you know, it's a data structure. It has fields. You know, the most important fields are, you know, source,
IP address and destination. You know, those two, you know, most important things, and there's other things like your checksum and, you know, lots of other things. But this is the header. And then you have a payload of some number of bytes. And if you want to define other protocols and other types, what you end up doing is taking this payload and cutting off part of it and making that a header for some other protocol, and then you have more bytes for a smaller payload. You might say, well, how big can this packet be? Well, kind of depends on what everyone's willing to take. Standard size is around 1,500 bytes, but there are smaller ones and there are larger sizes that can be accepted. But again, it doesn't really matter. It's all really about, I'm sending a packet from this address to this address with this stuff. It's really kind of a, I mean, that's what a datagram is, data. What are its security properties? And what, look at this thing, what?
If you mess with any part of the packet, the checksum usually can tell correct it or no?
Checksums are usually fake. We just have to recompute the checksum for this. There's no, the key takeaway for this, it is unprotected completely against any kind of attack you can think of on it. It's not authenticated. There's no way to guarantee where it came from. There is no confidentiality guarantee. It's all in the open. You know exactly where the packet's coming from. You know exactly where it's going to. Everywhere, you know, everyone who touches it on the way from its source to destination gets to see the full contents. There's no integrity, but anyone along the line can change it arbitrarily. In fact, much of our functionality in the modern internet depends on people messing with packets. When we talk about network address translation, it's messing with the destination and source IP addresses. It's mangling the packets. So, first approximation. Why is there problems with network security? It's because there is no security built into the network. Now you might say, well, those stupid internet designers, why didn't they build security in? I've heard rumors that you're supposed to build security in always into something in order to make it, you know, because if you bolt it on later, then it's all problematic. Now, how would you secure it? How should you secure it? You want to send around these things, and you've got certain fundamental problems about locking this down. So, what attacks can you perform on a set of IP packets? Well, you know, there's eavesdropping. So, what's the solution for eavesdropping? We know how to solve that, right? So, encrypt. So, we'll say problem. Problem, solution. But there's a problem with that. What's the problem with my thing if I can actually encrypt the packet?
You can only encrypt the payload.
You can only encrypt the payload. Okay, you encrypt the payload. Okay. We'll talk about that in a second. But let's assume that you've encrypted the payload. What attack now are you subject to? Someone can't eavesdrop, but what can they do?
They can redirect it.
Well, so let's say confidentiality, integrity, availability. So there's always the integrity part, but assuming you are doing proper encryption, let's assume you include integrity protections.
You could like spoof where it was actually sent from.
Okay, so so encrypting the payload, you don't know necessarily where it comes from. So that's related to that. I'm thinking a little more fundamental though.
I was gonna say, like, if they knew something about, like, if the packets you were sending has something to do with the bank transaction, they could basically just copy the packets and send them on your behalf.
So there's replay kind of things. If you do crypto properly, you can guard against these kind of things.
If it's public key cryptography, couldn't they replace the payload?
Public key cryptography, they could replace the payload. Well, if it's done improperly, yes. Proper crypto actually helps protect against that because then what you'd do is you'd have to be, okay, it's encrypted with the proper public key, but where is it coming from? And so you have authenticated sessions and stuff. We'll talk about that a little more, but I'm looking at something a little, in some sense, simpler, but actually more devastating as an attack.
You can tell who's sending messages between each other?
Who is talking to whom? So if you can't eavesdrop on the conversation, but it's called traffic analysis. Who is talking to whom? You might think, "Oh, wait, that doesn't matter so much." But actually it does. If you look at intelligence agencies and what they do, so much of what they find out about people is simply through traffic analysis. And because it's like, what can you find out from traffic? You find out, where do you spend your time? Who do you talk to? How much can you know about you by knowing who you talk to, when you talk to them, and from where you talk to them? If you know all these things, I mean, you know a lot. If you're looking at your privacy or something, think about, if someone's trying to do something that they shouldn't be doing, how much of it is revealed just from that? A huge amount. So, still got traffic analysis. How do you protect against that?
VPN service?
VPN service. So you want some way to encrypt your header. And that's really what it comes down to. Is the only way to prevent traffic analysis. Well, is to basically encrypt the headers. But it's actually worse than that, than just encrypting the headers. Because if you assume that you encrypt your headers, if they know where you're coming from, like they know, okay, like they're eavesdropping on particular network segments and stuff, they might still be able to distinguish where traffic is coming from, and they might be able to tell things just by how fast the network is coming, the rate of the packets, how big they are, into arrival times.
Signal actually used a way of circumventing network blocks by going through stuff like Google to do their stuff into censored networks.
Yeah, well, so that's a separate problem. That's called, how do I get connectivity where I'm being blocked?
Yes.
And that's, you always have to worry about availability, because if you can't do something, then that. But I'm talking here about traffic analysis, which is, how do I prevent people from watching my traffic? I'm saying that even if you encrypt the header, it's not necessarily enough. You have to encrypt it, and you have to mask it. You have to mask the traffic flows so that you can't tell. I mean, the classic way of doing this is you completely fill the network. You make it so that you're always sending packets. I mean, this is a defense against the pizza delivery attack. So let's say you're a military organization. You're going to plan an attack. Planning an attack, that's going to require extra time. People may actually have to stay after hours. So your intelligence analyst from a foreign power, you're going like, when are they going to plan an attack? What are they doing? It's like, oh, look, they're getting pizza delivered late at night. They must be planning something. So what's the solution for them telling that, oh, you're planning something, you know, because I see pizza delivered? Make sure the pizza's delivered all the time. And you may actually have to throw away the pizza most of the time, because most of the time people have gone home. But then what if they start looking at when cars are there? Okay, now you have to make sure the trap parking lot's always full of cars, so you can't tell when people leave work, because traffic analysis is hard to prevent. And it's, if you really want to prevent it, you typically have to use wasteful solutions. I mean, if you really care about people not understanding what you're doing, the number of ways we leak information nowadays is just insane. It's just everywhere. So traffic analysis is a hard problem to prevent. The classic way you can, so one way is you ideally want to make sure your network connection is just fully occupied, which is very wasteful. One thing that gets you much of the protection is to use a trusted intermediary. So, for example, you could, instead of having your pizza delivered directly to the building, you could have it delivered to a nondescript building or random buildings around the city, and then you have a dedicated shuttle service that just brings the pizza to the thing, and that shuttle service is always running. So the pizza service doesn't even know they're delivering things to, the military organization. They're just delivering it to random other points, and then there's a shuttle service, a trusted shuttle service, that brings it from there to the military planners, so they can stay up late and not be hungry. That's in part what a VPN is. We'll talk exactly what a VPN is from a technological point of view in a bit.
Would that be something like what Tor does? Or?
So, you might say, well, what if I just monitor those points? Like, I know that they're always using these five different buildings. What if I just monitor those five different buildings? Then I can find out when the pizza's being delivered. Well, what if you have the pizza actually delivered to another, set of buildings, and they get shuttled there, or maybe you ran over there, and they, whenever you deliver it to one of these places, it actually, instead of sending it to the destination, it sends it to another one. And then they, in an unmarked vehicle, and then it sends another one, and then another one. And just, you bounce it around lots of times. Now, you have the problem that the pizza's going to get cold. But it'll eventually get to a destination. That's Tor. That's called onion routing. So instead of sending it from point A to point B, you send it from A to C to D to E to F to G, and A doesn't know about, A just sent it to, C, and then C doesn't know about, C knows about D, and then D knows about E, but no one knows the whole route it's going to take. It's encrypted multiple times. That's the onion part. You have to peel off a layer of encryption every time in order to send it from destination to destination. The first, all that you know at any point is where you're going to and where it's immediately come from. You don't know the ultimate destination or source. Only the one who initially sent it knows that. So, that's a way of, protecting things, but then you have all this extra encryption, decryption that has to happen, and it certainly makes the performance go down. So the Tor is a system now for doing this. Lots of people use it, but not really that many because it's pretty darn slow, and it really doesn't scale. Because if you think about it, how it's set up. People are trying to work on scalable versions of it, but it's a very hard technical problem.
It's also not good when your exit node is poisoned?
Yes. Well, in principle, Tor is designed to, if you do things right, even if your exit node is compromised, you shouldn't actually be that out of shape. But the problem is, most of the time, people aren't. They're communicating with other endpoints, and so whoever at the end of the day makes it go out to the regular internet, you're vulnerable there.
Yeah.
And you can be tracked from that point.
The exit node.
But this is getting off top. We're getting further along the lines. I'm trying to break this down to basic concepts here. That you've got a packet. Packet has to have a source and destination, because you got to know where it comes from and goes to. If you start trying to, if you leave that open, you're vulnerable to attack. If you start encrypting it, you hobble your functionality. So it's not that the designers of the internet were dumb. It's that to try to get security guarantees at this level just starts becoming quickly infeasible. We don't really know how to do that. I mean, the other way to do it is basically only use trusted networks. But if you're totally talking about a large internet, you don't trust all the networks your packets are going to go down.
They chose flexibility instead of security?
Functionality, flexibility.
Yeah.
They decided to work because they weren't trying to get that much. If they were trying to get that much functionality, they wouldn't do it. It's just like military organizations have to use regular roads with their vehicles exposed to observation from third parties. Why do they do that? Because to do something else. I mean, they could build their own road network underground to connect every place they want to, have exchange of goods with, and that would be more secure, and that would be prohibitively expensive. And who prevents the attacker from just getting into that underground network and placing their cameras there? So this is the security costs. And how much security you want costs some way. Some things are cheaper than others. But when you see fundamental problems, the issues go like, well, when you see a problem that's everywhere, it may just be fundamental. If it's fundamental, then it's, you can't just say, oh, I'm just gonna solve it this way. It's, you're going to have to sacrifice something that you care about. Let's say, we're gonna forget about this whole header thing. We're gonna be talking about networks where you can't really be observed, your communication trap analysis. That's, as I say, onion routing, other things, more advanced topics, and it's not practical. It's not how you do most things because it just doesn't work. We're gonna have to leave this open to a large degree. What can we do, however, with the payload? Another thing. And there we get into another nasty problem. Key management. I'm going to send these packets to arbitrary other machines. This is my protocol for communicating with them. Let's assume we're going to do proper security. That means I'm going to authenticate them and then encrypt it and all those things. So what do I need as a base of it? I need to be able to identify that destination. I need their public key. So now, first off, if I assume I'm going to use public key cryptography to do this thing, now all of a sudden I've done something that can't fit in a packet. I'd have to use a big chunk of my bytes. I need more than one packet worth of information to establish an authenticated connection. So okay, I'm going to blow some number of packets, and then I'm going to have to then use them otherwise. So that's a cost. But let's assume you are willing to pay that cost. Even so, because we are in general nowadays. But where do I get the key for my destination? I know I want to connect to this IP address. How do I get its key? You might say, well, how do you know you want to connect to that IP address? However you knew you had to connect to that IP address, they should give you the key. Okay, sure. How do we decide what IP address to connect to? You normally specify numbers. Oh, by the way, there's IPv4 and IPv6. We all should be moving towards IPv6. North America was still mostly using IPv4. Really, there's only one big difference. I mean, there's also that's really only one fundamental difference between the two. The difference is IPv4 has 32-bit addresses for source and destination IP addresses. IPv6 has 128 bits. That's basically it. And there are other tweaks to it and other things, and actually it's IPv6 requires support of IPsec, but actually no one actually uses IPsec because IPsec is not encrypting packets, and we'll describe how that's just difficult. So key management. I need to identify, I have an IP address, I need to know what public key I should use for it. You might say, well, you could just say, well, you know, whoever told you to use that IP address, they'll give you the key. Okay. That kind of helps, that kind of solves it, and kind of really doesn't. So how do I know what IP address do I connect to today is using a system called DNS, the domain name system. DNS is actually pretty cool from an architectural point of view because it's really a highly available distributed database. Highly distributed, available hierarchical key value store. That's what it is. Because anytime you see a domain name that's divided into sections, like with dots, the dots denote levels of a hierarchy. There is implicitly a dot at the end of every domain address. So if you say .com, it's really .com dot. And that end dot represents the root of the hierarchy, which is the root name servers. So in order to figure out the IP address associated with the name, you go to the root name server, you ask it, okay, I need to get .com. What IP address is that associated with? Okay, it goes there. Okay, for .com, I want to get to Google. Okay, so Google, I then have to, the .com table tells me what Google's is. I go to Google and I ask the Google one that says, okay, I need www, okay, then it tells me what IP address for that. So it's a hierarchical lookup of machine to machine to machine, all these tables telling us to get to a final IP address. And that's cached and it's distributed and other things. That's so it works. So maybe DNS could give me, so maybe it could go from host name. So normally it's host name to IP address. What about plus? So wouldn't it be nice when you did all this that it actually gave you the public key for it? Sure. There is a standard for this. It is not, well first off, if I just, DNS is a bunch of records. I can just stick a public key as one of the text records in for DNS. DNS supports all things, I can just stick it in there. Is that really what I want to do, though? No, because if I just stick it in there, how do I know I have the right key? DNS, if that just assumes that DNS is secure. It's not. There's no cryptographic protections in traditional DNS. There's lots of ways to spoof things and make it. So basically, you look up google.com, oh no, you get a completely different IP address. I mean, really, normally when you connect to any network, it gives you a DNS address by default to use, and a name server. So when you connect to the Carlton network using Carlton's DNS servers, what's to prevent Carlton's DNS servers from lying to you about the IP address of the rest of the internet? Nothing. At all. And I said, well, I'll just use my own DNS servers. Well, it's very possible for your network provider to block that traffic. So you have to use their name servers. So, okay, how do I make sure this is the correct key? I have to actually implement cryptography on the entire database. I have to authenticate the entire database. And then the question is, who has authority to update the database. Who has the right keys? Just like you're talking about, who gets to sign the code that runs on your computer? It's the same darn problem. Who signs the records that map the names to IP addresses and authenticates those mappings? Who do you trust to do that? And who do you delegate trust to? There is a standard for doing this. DNSSEC. And they are trying to put this out there, but it's complicated. It's complicated for one simple reason. How do you decide who gets the keys and how do you manage them? And when someone's key gets compromised, how do you update it and stuff? Crypto is wonderful in theory and very, very painful in practice. So, that assumes if you want to do things on the entire internet and you want to be able to send authenticated encrypted packets to any machine on the network, it'd be great if I could just look it up, get their key, make sure their key is authenticated, then I can communicate with them. This in general cannot be done today. So you go, darn it. What do I do instead? What you do instead is you do solutions that are partial. It's only cover you for part of the way. Or you know, part of the way as in limited. So examples. Use them all the time. I mean, you do it this, you potentially do it the same way you do it with the browser. Yeah, you'd have a list of keys that you trust, and then your provider would provide them, and yeah. That's how you would, and that's how you do it, and that's subject to lots of problems. DNSSEC is not so new now. It's being deployed, but from a management perspective, it's painful. So, we'll see. So the solution people are using before DNSSEC, and I think, and I honestly do not think DNSSEC is the future. I don't think it will really take over, because I think the key management are always going to be problematic. I think there'll be a patchwork of DNSSEC, but it won't be enough to be able to say, well, I don't know, it's hard to predict these things. But it's not the problem you actually care about. Which you normally care about. I mean, if you let go of, okay, I cannot prevent traffic analysis, people are going to see where I'm communicating with. Then you just care about making sure my communication with the other endpoint is secure. What's the solution we use? We use SSH or TLS. Those protocols give us what we want. But, again, those protocols all work in the payload. They do nothing to the headers. But all they can, and in fact, from a first approximation to me, they don't care about IP addresses. They maybe look at domain names, or they look at, okay, you presented this public key, okay, is that who we think you are? And so they we mostly circumvent the issue of having to worry about this part. We just are doing things in the payload, we're exchanging information, we're authenticating it with this. And that gives us end-to-end protection, except that now everyone can see that those two endpoints are communicating. That's always there. So that's happening with every endpoint. So someone's monitoring your network, they know that you're talking to your bank. They don't know what you're saying, but they know when you're talking to your bank, and they know how much information was exchanged, and the timing. And the timing and how much information is exchanged can be enough to reveal amazing amounts of information. Anyone know about the voice over IP attacks? It is possible to listen in on someone's conversation when they are having an encrypted voice communication over like voice over IP. So you, let's say you're just talking to someone on FaceTime audio or SIP or what, I mean, any of these protocols for sending audio over the internet. A lot of these protocols are encrypted. But because of the varying bandwidth requirements, so that speech is compressed. How much it's compressed depends upon what is being said. That's an information leak. And if you map that to the common, you know, phonemes of how a conversation broke it down, you can actually turn that into listening into the talk of two people chatting away. You haven't actually cracked the conversation. It might be a bit distorted, but you can actually figure out what the words that are being said simply by how they map to the size of the packets and the timing.
A relatively recent news article I saw about Tinder said that you could tell, or they didn't encrypt people's pictures.
Yeah.
And then based off, like, they encrypted their messages, but based off the sizes and stuff like that, messages, you could tell whether you swipe left or right or whatever else.
Yeah. Dating apps are. I've actually written papers on dating app security, but from a different perspective. But yeah, no, it's not. Anyway, but if you can watch what's happening on the network for something, even if it's encrypted, you can often find out a lot.
And is that type of attack going to become more problematic with advances in like AI and pattern recognition?
Definitely.
Yeah,
machine learning is definitely makes that stuff much easier. In order to find the patterns, you need lots of data and lots of computational power. Those both are going up. So. So I can't mask all of my traffic so no one can see where it's going. Even if I send encrypted traffic by this, I still will leak some information about what I'm actually communicating. Because I can't just fill the channel with arbitrary data, and I probably still need to use compression in order to make things work. And that'll leak stuff. So what else can I do? This is where VPNs come in. So this is why I really want to talk about this, so I can explain. What is a VPN? What does it buy you? What does it not buy you? So in this panel, in this thing here, talking about a packet, VPN, it's encrypted traffic. Encrypted network traffic. So encrypted network traffic, the two questions you have to ask is, what part of the traffic is encrypted? And how is it authenticated? That's your basic thing if you're looking at communication. How are you authenticating it, and what's being encrypted? What's being encrypted with the VPN? The whole packet. Header and payload. So, good news. Right? But then you should go like, wait a second. You just told me that you can't, so, how am I encrypting the header and payload? There must be a catch.
There's still an exposed header, but that header is to the VPN.
Right. So the full traffic is encrypted, but it's encapsulated. So inside of this so what's happening is you have a source and destination IP address. The source IP address for you send data out is, say, your laptop, and the destination is your VPN provider. Maybe it's the VPN gateway for your that you've have a subscription with, or maybe it's the VPN gateway from Carlton or something, but all your traffic looks like is between your, anyone observing your traffic will see that you're sending encrypted traffic to and from your VPN gateway. That's all they see. And then, but then what happens? The VPN gateway decrypts your traffic and sends it on. And that traffic should just look like it's coming from the VPN gateway. Now, you can say, well, what if it just sends out there, but then it uses the IP address of your laptop? Well, that's dumb. Now you just identified yourself to the world. So, how different VPNs do this differently, how much they mask it. I mean, they may do network address translation, so it looks like coming from one IP address. Or they may actually give you more common is they give you a corporate IP address. And so all your traffic looks like it's coming from the corporation or the organization. So you have a semi-unique identifier going out to the world. But that's not your laptops. But all you've done with a VPN is move the problem. Instead of the problem being from, I want to make sure no one can observe traffic coming out of my laptop, you have to make sure no one can observe traffic coming out of my VPN provider. So why is that better? When is that better?
Can the VPN keep their network full? Usually?
Well, so that they have more traffic. So there's more mixing of traffic, so that can help. Although it may still be able to be teased out what's going out from there, depending on what things are doing. Are they in a, the typical reason people say to use a VPN is that it gets you past anyone messing with your local network. There's a number of attacks, like if you're on Wi-Fi, or if someone's on the same network segment as you, they can mess with you. Like, they can directly mess with your DNS lookups. Now, you think you're connecting to machines you aren't supposed to. They can directly listen in, and they know that, oh, your laptop's right there. So if the attacker's close to you in the network space, it's much easier to get at you. If they have to compromise a VPN system that's much further away, that is better maintained, that has... it's probably trying to cross other people. It's in principle a harder target to compromise. You must be going, well, is it really that much better? Like people always say, don't do your banking on a public Wi-Fi network. If you're really doing your banking on a public Wi-Fi network, what is the protection that you have? You have the protection of the authentication of the TLS protocol. That is the thing that actually protects you end to end. Can this TLS protocol be messed with? Yes, if you are trusting the wrong keys. But trusting the wrong keys or not is something depending on the software that's installed on your system. If someone messes with your network and just has access to your network, they can introduce errors, or they can redirect you to other places, but it will show up that all of a sudden you're connecting to a different place. Or it'll get an error saying, okay, you're getting an invalid certificate. My view is that it's not to say someone can't mess with you on local network, but people can mess with you anywhere in the network. You're always subject to attack. So if you're doing banking on the internet ever, you should be careful with looking at the certificates and making sure you're connecting to the right websites. Like, clicking on links in email is dangerous. Type in the links or you go use your bookmarks instead.
I actually received a text message from a random number that told me something about my banking information being screwy. It actually had a very similar domain name to RBC's actual website. And what they did is they had an overlay on top of RBC's website, which would capture your user login and then redirect you to the RBC's website.
And this is, I mean, this comes down to the hosting. If you're not connecting to the right hosting, you're in trouble. How do you know you're connecting to the right hosting? You know one great way people find everything on the internet? It's not by typing in host names. It's by using search engines. So many people, when they want to visit sites they care about, they type it into the URL bar, go through a search engine, and then go there. And you know something? That's probably actually more secure than them just typing in the regular user, you know, host name and making sure there's no typos. Because the typo, who knows where they'll end up. But they go to search engine. Search engines generally give you the right result for the top one. Generally. At least they have a reason to do that. So there's a question over here. Yep.
You know, I just want to mention that also just happened with me for PayPal as well.
Oh.
And the formatting in the email was kind of off. And if you're to look a little bit deeper into the email, you see it's very off. So.
Good phishing attacks, particularly targeted phishing attacks known as spear phishing, you can't tell. And if they exploit certain vulnerabilities, you really can't tell.
There was even a Google attack where they were using different Unicode characters that looked identical to GOOGLE. And then they completely, CSS was on par with Google style. And
yeah, you look a visual inspection, you can't tell anything.
Can't you always tell by like the hosting of the
No, that's what I was saying. You can't tell because what happens if they've encoded it in some way that looks visually the same, but they're using non-standard Unicode characters? Right? They're using it from another completely different alphabet. So this is the thing to understand about attacks, is the depth of attacks you see, it always gets deeper. It's like, how many levels can you go down? And that's why it's good to understand these things at more in principled way. And like, what can you have a firm guarantee on, and what can you not have a firm guarantee on? And saying like, okay, you want end-to-end protection. Okay, what's the requirement of there? Where could you get messed with? If an untrusted source provides you information on how to connect to your other end, you know the notion. Well, if it's untrusted, but I can make it trusted. You might be able to, you might get do it for the time, but you can be fooled. The only way to really make sure you're doing a trusted end is that you have trust at the beginning and the trust continues on. So maybe you know that, oh, if I go to Google, in order to get to Google, I have to type in google.com. That's a level of trust because you know, as you hopefully trust your ability to spell name, or maybe you use a bookmark which is built into your browser, so okay, now you know you're going to that site, you're going to your bank, you know that's the domain there. The way I do my banking personally is I have a separate browser configuration. Like Firefox supports multiple browser profiles, I do all my banking in a separate browser profile, which I do not surf the regular internet in. I just visit my financial websites. I have a set of bookmarks, and I just load those bookmarks. So I go to my sites and I do my banking there, and when I'm done with that, I close that and I open up my regular browser profile. So it's not to say I couldn't do, why can't I just type in my bank thing and do it? There's just so many ways I could potentially mess with. Trying to make sure that I avoid all those problems is difficult. So you got to make sure you start with the right trust end. But now, of course, by using that sort of thing, I don't care where I connect to it. I connect it from any network because the network is not trusted. I never trust my network. I assume that someone could be messing with me all the time. And if I start seeing certificate errors or other things like that, I go, "What crap?" I then go, "Okay, if I see any sort of unusual activity or some any errors, I'm going, like, I'm not going to do that." But I'm starting with a trusted source because I established those bookmarks long ago and they've kept working. And so, of course, sometimes banks are really dumb and they change things on their website, and then it's like, okay, now I have to verify it and check it from another website, another connection. It's dumb. But what is your path of trust? What is the thing you trust? You cannot trust host names because DNS can be messed with. You cannot trust IP addresses because these are rewritten all the time. The only thing at the end of the day you can trust is what's in the payload, and the only way you can trust what's in the payload is because you've used some other mechanism of authenticating it. So this really gets back to why I was ranting about VPNs. It's not that VPNs provide no security, it's just they provide the security that you don't actually care about. And then if you actually cared about that security, you're doing security. So like when the classic reason for a corporation to use a VPN is that if you go through the VPN, then you are protected from all the bad things that could be happening on the hotel Wi-Fi network or the other places. You know, you're protected from all that. And that's okay, but now, I mean, if you're just connecting to your corporate resources and you're kind of in that network, it's like, okay, you have something there, but now, do you trust that laptop? There's the endpoint problem. It's like, the corporate services, do they trust this random endpoint? They really shouldn't. But you can see why this is an issue, because now you're seeing, okay, this one, how is this one connected? You can only do real authentication end-to-end. But even that is not, but that doesn't protect you against traffic analysis. So, yep. Mm-hmm.
I was just going to say that you could probably authenticate that endpoint, that laptop. You could have a way of trusting it.
You could authenticate it.
You could have a way of trusting it.
Right. But if you had a way of trusting it, like, if you need require a way of trusting it, you would then just connect over regular, you know, web connection. I mean, a VPN provides a little bit of a higher bar because typically, so I didn't talk about how you authenticate to a VPN, which is actually what is where there is some advantage to them versus normal web traffic. How do you authenticate to a classic website? Yeah, how they are authenticated to you is that you download a certificate for the website, and that certificate has been vouched for by one of the authorities that's built into your browser. That's how you know you're visiting an authenticated website that has false, but okay. But how do you do the reverse? How does the bank know it's you?
Usually with a password.
Username, password. Or maybe some sort of crappy two-factor authentication. So that's how it knows about you. That's not that strong.
Don't they also layer in like IP address recognition? Like if you're constantly logging in from the same address, they'll sort of implicitly trust you more than if you were to change, right? When they ask you like, oh, can you just verify when you have a new network address? Right, so, I don't know if that falls under like two-factor or?
There are things they check that. They certainly check your cookies. They check your browser state. They try to do other things. Those are all weak authenticators. Yeah, I'm not saying you can't. Okay. I'm not saying they're. It's fine if it's a notebook, not a notebook. Wait, was that your computer? Oh.
Didn't need that money anyway.
Yeah. So it's one thing for. How do you authenticate? How do you authenticate to the remote site? Because that's ultimately what. You know, if it's a secure service that you really care about, you connect it. So, like, your corporation should care about you authenticating from your laptop that it really is you. How do you get better than a username and password?
You can have keys. Like, for my work VPN, I have a key on a memory stick.
Right. So, you can have a public key to identify yourself. And you have a private key. And then you show your public key to the remote site, to your VPN provider to your corporation and say, here is my identity. And because it's identified with that, now you have stronger authentication than you would if you just provided username and password. Because that's much harder to, you can't type that into the wrong website. Because your private key never leaves your system. So no one can ever steal it. You ever know about YubiKeys?
Yes.
Do I have a YubiKey? I actually got one over the Christmas break. And I never actually set it up. I'm just wondering if I kept it in my backpack or not. I don't know where I put my YubiKeys. That's really sad. They're like $50 a piece.
I should really find it.
So what I'm talking about is there are these little hardware tokens that you can use to store your secret keys. You might go, like, if your secrets are being stored on your laptop, what happens if your laptop gets compromised? So these little hardware tokens can have that. They're little computers. Those computers can either authenticate to your laptop, communicate by USB, or even RFID, so like you can use it with your phone. Works better with Android phones than iOS phones, but that's another way. But again, this is all just saying it would be better to authenticate to the VPN using public key cryptography rather than using a password. So why don't we use that all the time?
It's expensive.
It's expensive in what sense? I want to authenticate to my VPN provider, which is typically a corporation or something. I have to maybe have some sort of communication with them of saying, okay, let me set up this is my public key, I'll give it to you there, let's make sure, some sort of secure enrollment thing to set that up, and then now they have my public key, and it's all good. How about doing that with 1,000 websites?
No.
I mean, how many username and passwords do you use?
Wait. It's a question.
Yes. I mean, that's the problem of using public key cryptography as an identifier for you as an individual to remote services is a usability problem. No more, no less. Well, it's a usability and then privacy issue. So let's think of a scheme by which I can identify myself. I could have a government or another organization issue me an ID. When people talk about having a driver's license for the internet, so why doesn't the government or some other organization issue you a public, public-private key pair. You are now this public key. This is you. Use that to authenticate to all the websites.
Two things. That is actually already done, I believe, in Estonia.
And South Korea.
But besides that, what if you don't want to be identified by your real...
That's the thing. It's that sort of ID is not necessarily a bad thing, but now you've really identified yourself.
Wouldn't you say that's kind of like a password manager to some extent, too?
I mean, storing those keys?
Well, yeah, like, the smaller is what you would want, ideally, if you were doing something like that, because it's just a password size key, but...
Right. Well, it's so certainly you could use a manager for it, but it comes down to management. Okay, you have one organization issuing you a key. You have one identity that you have to use everywhere. Now everyone can know exactly who you are, you can cross-correlate. You don't need to do that to some degree, but people worry about privacy for that. What happens when the cryptography in that identifier gets messed up? How do you update everyone's identifiers? Because the cryptography will break.
Yep.
So now everyone's in big trouble at the same time. That's happened actually in like Estonia or something. They actually found out that their system for issuing IDs was insecure. And so that's one problem. And then, okay, let's have a manager. I have to now manage it. How do I explain to people what this is? It's one thing to say, okay, here is this. This is your token, stick this in, and now you log in. Now you have 1,000 identities associated with public keys, and they have to do this public-private thing. what's the mental model you're going to teach people about? You have to teach them about public key cryptography.
I have a government-issued public key as part of being a government employee, and the model they use is literally a key in a lock. You lock emails, then someone else will unlock them. Even the not super technical people get that.
Right. It's fine as long if you have it tied to a physical token. It works. It can work pretty well. But when you make it virtual, and then you try to give people a way of like, how do you say what do you keep secure? I mean, they understand passwords, but you give away the passwords. Now you have to convince people, give everyone your public key, but never give anyone your secret key. One is one file, the other is another file. Only give away one, not the other. And then you might say, oh, we'll tie it to a hardware token. So now this is a token I can use, but now how do you... Now you have a problem with organizations of which hardware tokens will they trust? Which keys will they trust? I mean, it's not a technical problem. It's a organizational, human, usability problem. But even if we solve that, so let's assume a world. So let's assume different versions of the world with networking. One is, let's assume a world where no one can do traffic analysis. What does that world look like when no one can do traffic analysis? I don't actually even know what that world looks like. Because I don't know how to send data around. I mean, the only way I can think of sending this around is like doing sort of an onion routing, so everything that you send around actually bounces around the internet, you know, 500 times before it gets to its destination. I don't see how you do high performance networking with that. You know, it's just... Mm-hmm.
Well, it would have to be a different method of transmission, so instead of going, it would have to be point to point with nothing in between, like quantum mechanics.
So if you use quantum cryptography, so basically all quantum cryptography, I'll just tell you, quantum cryptography lets you communicate bits from point A to point B in a way that if anyone eavesdrops, they change the communication. So that's really cool. But it's point to point. It's not, oh, I can go to this machine and this machine will connect me to 100 million other systems. Nope. So I don't know how to do traffic analysis. The only way I can think of how you can do avoiding traffic analysis is to have trusted hardware in every network router. So that no one could, basically they always had keys that you would encrypt things to, and they would never reveal their information to anyone else. I don't think that's happening. So, we're not,
What about like decentralized internet blockchain technology?
What property would the blockchain get you?
Not so much the blockchain, but decentralizing the internet using that way. That way you have, like, everyone who's part of the network is its own node, and then you have this almost, like, trusted node.
What does it buy you? You change the network topology, you still have routers. You still have someone who has to send your packets on to everyone else. That's how you make the graph. I mean, it's really graph theory. It's like, I've got these points all over here. I want to make an edge from here to here, but I want to connect from this point to this point, but I only have connectivity from here to here. So how do I get to there? I got to go through somewhere, and then I got to go from there, and then I got to go from there. It's just graphs.
Yeah, the entire network, world's like network infrastructure was based off like fiber optics. Would it be fast enough for any routing?
Well, fiber optics is great, but that I do not have a fully connected graph. It is unreasonable to think of a fully connected point-to-point graph. I mean, I have a connection to every of like to 5 billion other computers directly.
No, I'm not going to have that. I'm going to send my data by way of other gateways. And those other gateways are going to have to know something about how to send the information on. Now, you might be able to do things where you only have point-to-point information. But in order to have only point-to-point information, that means you're going to have to encrypt and decrypt things around the network, and you're going to have to shuffle it all around. And basically, you get onion routing. And when you start thinking about onion routing, you start thinking about, I mean, it's just bouncing around the network with lots of keys. It's not fundamentally efficient. I mean, you could always use it for a subset of things. It's not going to be most network traffic.
I actually went to a talk at QSEC about quantum cryptography.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually are working on hardware where you can have things. They will have routers that don't touch the actual encryption and do forward and on. So there is going to be sort of an internet of quantum cryptography.
Maybe.
It's just
the trouble is, how do you forward it? Are you going to have every light connection go to every node? At some point, you have to specify where you're going.
Yeah, that's the problem.
You have to do routing. Maybe you can do something where you're saying, I'm going to Europe. All I have to know is going to Europe. But that, again, is onion routing. If you do something like that, okay, you get some of it. But I don't see that happening. But so if we're not doing that, the network can see your traffic. You can encrypt your payloads. And you want to do authenticate. We kind of tried doing this with DNSSEC and other things, but at the end of the day, it's really about end-to-end. And end-to-end means that your network traffic is insecure. You just layer on top of it an end-to-end protocol like SSH or TLS to authenticate your connection, and you don't care who messes with it because we're securing it on either end. And if you secure it on either end, then the question is, well, how do you know you're connecting to the right endpoint? And then maybe you start, there's ways of getting better infrastructure for that. But there's no simple solution to just allow for secure communication with the entire world. The VPN is it's the equivalent of SSL, SSH, or TLS, but part of the way. Not end to end. It's not endpoint to endpoint. It's endpoint to network. And so now you've authenticated and encrypted your connection to the network, and then from that network, you're back to where you were. And that may be good, maybe not. I mean, another use for VPNs is instead of endpoint to network, it's network to network. So let's say you have a corporation, but let's say your organization, you have a satellite office. Satellite office has 10 machines, main installation is 1,000 machines. Let's bridge them together. That's what you use a VPN for. It's all the same stuff. There's lots of different protocols, lots of different details, but it's all the same stuff. The thing you always have to ask is, where did my keys come from? Who authenticated them? And oh God, I'm using cryptography. What's going to break? Okay, that's it for today.